Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to the show. So glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here. We've got a great show coming up. Jared Stepman's going to be with us in just a few minutes from the Daily Signal. He gives us all we need to know about what's going on in Washington, D.C. And then Dr. Stephen Mansfield is going to be with us. He's written many books. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and he is going to talk about manhood. So I got to play my man card all day. And coming up in about 30 minutes is that interview as well. So if I'm working on trying to have a better attitude in life, you know, we can all work on that, right? Just have a better attitude. And when you develop a positive attitude, it can help you in really more ways than you realize. Because when you think really positive, truthful, biblical thoughts, it doesn't allow your mind to entertain as many negative thoughts. Now, that's easier said than done. But it says in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 7, for as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. So we have to ask ourselves about what's in our heart, what are we thinking, and then what thoughts are we having throughout the day? Because I got to tell you, I have a tendency once in a while just to have that little bit of melancholy cloud hanging over my head, and I don't always like it, but it is a little bit of my personality, which I guess I'm working on. Rebecca, you're looking at me like you're nuts, which I kind of am nuts.
No, you're just putting it out there. I think we're all probably feeling it. It's too easy to get trapped in the negative. It just is. And I'm not sure whether it's probably what we're taking in. And maybe I need to guard my heart a little bit more so that when I notice these negative thoughts are just piling up, that is not life. Those aren't the words of life. And that's not what I want to be dwelling on. I want to dwell on the good and the glory.
Yeah. Well, the Mr. Rogers documentary just came out and people are going to it in droves. I think they just want to go to something that they kind of feel comforted by and feel good about. And here's a kind person that's loving and gracious, and generous. And you go, that's not a bad dose of to help offset all the other negative things that are going on.
And yet he was very real and he was very intentional about putting those narratives out there, especially to raise children on those things.
Yeah.
And think there's a friend for you. This is a good thing. Here's how it looks to be a friend. I think maybe we need more of those lessons than we think.
And from what I understand, he lived in a neighborhood. So that's always a good thing, too. All right. We've got a great show coming up. Let's take a little break. When we come back, we'll have Jared Stepman with us. And as you know, I love scripture. Love it, love it, love it. So here's a passage from John chapter 3, verse 16.
John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life.
When I first started my journey as a writer, I had so many fears, but God has proven so faithful, and I'm so glad I took the steps, like going to a writer's conference, in order to share my writing with you. Hey friends, this is Susie Larson, and I want to encourage you today that even in the midst of your fears, God will meet you when you step out in faith. So if you're an aspiring writer, I would love to see you at the upcoming Northwestern Christian Writers Conference, July 13th and 14th.
Registration closes July 5th. Sign up at NorthwesternChristianWritersConference.com.
Every year, people look forward to gathering on July 4th to enjoy the spectacle of fireworks under a night sky. But why do we celebrate Independence Day? We should certainly be thankful for freedoms enjoyed in America. Jesus gave us a different freedom. He delivered us from the curse and death of sin. May we remember how much it cost our Savior to secure this precious freedom. From all of us at Haven today, happy Independence Day. I'm Charles Morris. We're all about Jesus.
Welcome back to the show. As you know, I'm already in the big 4th of July mode and predicting that 47 million people will travel over the 4th. That's a 5% increase from 2017. And my guest on our studio line right now is Jared Stepman. He's the editor and commentary writer for the Daily Signal and co-host of the Right Side of History podcast. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Are you part of that 47 million that will be traveling over the 4th?
Well, I won't be part of the 47 million that's traveling, but I do have a yearly tradition because I live in Washington, D.C. I make a very short trip across the Potomac to Mount Vernon, which is George Washington's historic home in Virginia. And every year I've been doing this since I moved to D.C. about 7 years ago. I place some flowers on the grave of George Washington and thanks for what he did to create our country. So I can't say it's a long trip, but it's a very special one to me that I hope is in tenor with the holiday in general.
That is very sweet and patriotic, and that's very cool. Thanks for telling us that story.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I think it's very important on the 4th of July to celebrate what this country is and not just, of course, enjoy time with your family and enjoy the food and enjoy that kind of time, but also spend a moment and be thankful for the fact that there were others who came before us who made our country possible. And I think that we have every reason to be very much thankful for that. And that's my small tribute to somebody who, gave everything for this country when it was founded.
Well, Jared, I just need to ask, where did you get this idea to do this and how long you've been doing it? And do you take anyone with you?
Well, today I take my wife with me. I initially used to go by myself. It was when I came to Washington, D.C. And I thought, I grew up in California. I wasn't close to where a founder's home or anything like that was. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing on the 4th of July to spend some time at the home that the father of our country spent most of his life with when he could? And to just give a little thanks to George Washington. I asked the people there if I could place some flowers by his grave, and they were very gracious and allowed me to do so. And to me, it was a very important tradition to start. And I decided, I should do this every year. Now that I'm here in Washington, D.C., I should show my thanks every year with something. I know it's a small tribute. I know it's a very small thing, but that's my way of showing gratitude to what George Washington did, as many other founders, of course, but in particular, George Washington is one of the most, really the central figure in our country's history.
Yeah, well, it's a sweet story, and I appreciate you sharing it. All right, we don't have a Supreme Court nominee quite yet, but let's just say there's panic going on.
Well, that is for sure, especially on the left. When they heard about Kennedy's retirement, I mean, this already came off of a string of cases that I think many on the left were not pleased about. And then on top of that, we had Kennedy retiring, who was kind of the swing vote on the court. He kind of had gone, a lot of different ways and different decisions. But I think what this moment means is that it's more likely that there's going to be a constitutionalist originalist that's on the court. Whoever President Donald Trump decides to nominate will likely join the kind of conservative majority on the court. So many on the left are already in full-blown panic mode because they're worried that a lot of precedent may be overturned. They're worried that a lot of what they see as their agenda will not be enforced by the court, will not be furthered by the court, which I think they've traditionally relied on. So you're seeing a lot of wailing nationally from a lot of left-wing groups and a lot of, I think, growing radicalism, too, because they see this massive sea change because of one vote change on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. When will the confirmation hearings begin? Do you know, Jarrett?
Yeah, well, so Trump has said that he will likely choose a candidate on July 9th, so it's coming up very soon.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, traditionally, hearings don't start for well over a month after the nomination takes place. It really depends on when the Senate decides to pick up the nomination process. Will have to go through committee. So I think traditionally it tends to be about a month and a half, 2 months after. Sometimes it takes longer. But it really depends on, of course, what the majority leader, the Senate majority leader, wants to do and what kind of support he thinks there is. So there's no direct process for this. It really varies from year to year, from presidency to presidency, and in the makeup of the Senate, often highly determines it. But if I was to guess, it'll happen sometime within the first few months of when the next justice is nominated.
Mm-hmm. Jared, at these confirmation hearings, what do you anticipate the Democrats doing besides, general hysteria?
Well, they're definitely going to – I think that they've already started to attack some of the personal views of some of the judges. I mean, I know that one in particular, Amy Barrett, who's a district judge, they've kind of attacked some of her or Catholic beliefs and things like this. So I think that this nomination in particular will get quite personal. I mean, we've seen a lot of course, attacks on nominees in the past, but because the stakes are so high in this case, I think they're going to be looking for any reason to torpedo one of these nominees. So I think you're going to get a higher level of acridness from Democrats because they realize the stakes are high. The problem they have is if Republicans are united in getting this justice through, there's not a whole lot Democrats can do to stop it because the filibuster rules were changed first by Senator Harry Reid in 2013 when he used the nuclear option, and now essentially the filibuster is off the table for Supreme Court nominees. So that changes things quite a bit for sure.
Now, I think there's been four people vetted. It's down to four, but do you think it's already narrowed down to two?
I do think it's been narrowed down to probably two, maybe three choices. I mean, we don't know exactly who those will be yet, and there can always be some surprises. I mean, that's always something that happens, and people have kind of circled around two, Kavanaugh and Bear. But, I mean, there are others on a larger list, so I wouldn't try to make any predictions as far as what's going to happen. I do think that the next choice will certainly be more in the originalist camp. I mean, obviously there are variations in the philosophy of different judges and the kind of line of cases that they've seen in the past. Most of them have a pretty extensive legal background. So I mean, certainly I think that the list that Trump originally had, he's going to follow. And I think he's down to probably two or three judges. And obviously on July 9th, we'll get the announcement.
Yeah, just about less than a minute before we go to break. Would you anticipate Justice Roberts now really being the swing vote on the Supreme Court?
Hey, well, it's very possible. But I think you're going to see a lot of 5-4 decisions. And, you know, Roberts now has probably more leeway to make, you could say, stronger originalist positions. He no longer has to court Kennedy and narrow the scope of his decision. So he could be a swing vote in the court, or he could use the fact that he has more solid majorities to make broader decisions on a lot of these big cases instead of kind of punting in the way that they have in some cases recently. So that there will definitely be a change in the way that the court operates in the future after this judge gets through.
Mm-hmm. Jarrett, let me take a little break. I'm speaking to Jarrett Stepman, editor and commentary writer for the Daily Signal and co-host of the Right Side of the History podcast. We'll take a short break and be back with more of Jarrett in just a minute. See, we were not gone long, were we? We're back. And we're talking to Jarrett Stepman. He's editor and commentary writer for the Daily Signal, also co-host of the Right Side of History podcast. Jarrett, as I look at some of the things coming out of the left, I see that they're now calling to abolish ICE. This seems a little desperate.
It is a little desperate, and it's quite radical. And it's quite curious to me. Of course, a lot of this has stemmed over, you know, the recent controversy over immigration and specifically the family detention and the separation of families. It is interesting that they particularly singled out ICE because really that was more Border Patrol's responsibility, not ICE. So there was a little bit of a mistake in identity there. And I think that the general call to get rid of this agency that really has a broad array of duties, not just in dealing with deportation, but also dealing with organized crime, human trafficking, drug trafficking. I mean, really a long list of issues that deal with the border. I mean, I think that ICE does hold a very critical role for the Republic in not just the immigration issue, but a whole host of other issues that surround that. So I think that most Americans are committed to the idea that ICE is an important integral agency, including many people who consider themselves Democrats. I mean, I think that is a big part of this, and it's a real risk for Democrats and especially Democrat leadership to jump aboard this idea of abolishing ICE, an agency that most Americans, if they have some understanding of what it is, more or less support. But that does appear to be their tactic right now, and it's becoming a really common slogan that you're seeing on the left. We've seen protests around the country using the slogan "abolish ICE," and have decided to wage war against it. So it's definitely going to be a theme in the near-term future for many, especially in the progressive base, to eliminate this agency. The problem they have is they don't really have an alternative otherwise other than just simply making America a more or less open borders country, which I think is what a lot of people fear.
Mm-hmm. Jared, it seems like the drumbeat nowadays is the call for more violence, especially that against conservatives. That is not a good trend.
Not at all. And I think this really, I mean, it really started with a series of very public cases of harassment of women who had worked in the Trump administration when they are in their private lives. And I think there was a particularly, in my opinion, a reckless call by Congresswoman Maxine Waters to harass people where they are in movie theaters and things like this. And, you know, I look, there's never been some golden age of civility in America. I mean, our politics have always been very bumptious and sometimes contentious. But at the same time, I mean, our country is very much based on the rule of law. It's based on hashing out our disagreements instead of using essentially mobs to go after political opponents. I mean, I think what this does is that it makes those who are people who disagree with you into your enemies, people who can't be reasoned with, people who just need to be shouted down and attacked. And I think that's a very dangerous place for a republic. I think it's happened before where we've had times where politics has got so acrimonious that we have led to things like violence. I mean, certainly in the 1950s and 70s, there was a series of bombings. And, of course, before the Civil War, there was a huge amount of mob violence. There was a huge amount of things. But that led to a war in which Americans were killing each other in large numbers. So I think this is a dangerous moment for our country. I think that responsible people will see that harassing people in their private lives and perhaps using violence against them is wrong and destroys the fabric of our country. So I think the common sense American hears calls like that, and I think they're more or less horrified.
Rand Paul had a threat to his family that somebody wanted to attack him and chop him up into pieces. That was pretty disturbing.
It is, and we've also had threats against FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, death threats against his family. And that's a very serious thing. And some who say that the Trump administration is so extreme that they just can't be dealt with normally, this is the rhetoric that was coming around tax cuts and around net neutrality and all these things. I mean, if those things really point to having behavior where you get violent with somebody who's your political opponent, you know, obviously people will hold different values and different viewpoints. The way to deal with that in our republic is not to immediately turn to violence, beat them down or threaten themselves or their family or people that aren't even connected. I think that is what is particularly disturbing to people. It's not just threatening people who are involved in politics. It's threatening their families. It's threatening anybody who associates with them. I think that's what gets a lot of Americans really worried and upset.
Now, Jared, you live in Washington, D.C., so let me just maybe you could give us some encouragement about how strong we still are as a nation.
Yeah, I do think we're very strong as a nation. You know, we've always dealt with these things in the past. And, of course, there's always the doomsayers that think that Americans is in tune for decline and that it's just something that's inevitable. But I remain very faithful that the United States, I mean, we've had these challenges before, in some cases much worse than before, and we've always seemed to prevail through them. I mean, you know, as bad as things are today, imagine how they were in 1860. Imagine even, I think many know how things were in the 1960s and in the 1970s. And so, in my opinion, through everything, the United States institutions are still the strongest and the greatest. I think our culture is, even though it has frayed some at the edges, I think it's still very strong. And I think that America really is a very much blessed country, and that despite whatever issues we have, I think that the next generation, things will be better for them. And I to a certain extent, it's just a hopefulness based on our history and our long traditions. I mean, we've seen dark times in the past, and we have almost always prevailed through, and having faith in that system and not losing touch of our history. I mean, I think that's why I do things like go visit George Washington's home. Of course, you know, George Washington was a great man. You know, we often don't see people quite so great, but there have been many great Americans. I mean, every generation has had to rise to the occasion. And so there were great challenges for them as well. I mean, the country was much less powerful and in a much less secure position in the world. I think we have a lot to be hopeful for. I mean, the United States and its problems, I'll take over any other country and its problems. I mean, that, at the end of the day, that's where I stay. And I think there are a lot of hopeful signs for this country that things will be better in the future and that these things, these dark times will definitely pass.
Oh, I love that enthusiasm, Jared. That makes makes me happy. So when you're having coffee with your colleagues and it's just a little bit off the record, what do you talk about that concerns you the most?
You know, I've observed in the last few years in particular, this particular war on American history. I mean, I talk about, you know, our traditions and where this country has been and the kind of decline in religion in America, I think very much worries me. And I do worry about these attacks on America's figures of the past. I mean, we see attacks on Thomas Jefferson at UVA, on the founders. And I think there's this increasing desire, especially those who are on the very far left, to roll back what is our history. And not that America has ever been a perfect place. I mean, far from it. But in very many ways, America has been great. I mean, it's been kind of the secret sauce of our civilization, has created more prosperity for more people than any civilization in history. And I think keeping that history and tradition alive, our culture and institutions, I think is an incredibly important thing. And I worry that, you know, that younger people are not educated about it, are not taught about what their country really was and what it's meant for so many people, for millions of people in our entire history. And I think that is what worries me the most, is that a loss of shared traditions of our nation. And I think that for me personally, keeping those things alive is more important than any other single issue.
Mm-hmm. So, Jared, if we're sitting around the barbecue grill, what's a good question to ask in the backyard picnic tomorrow?
Well, I would definitely ask, especially for younger people, you know, ask them, what is this country founded on? I mean, what are the traditions? What are the institutions of our country? I mean, I would read the Declaration of Independence out. This is something my wife and I do every year. We read the Declaration of Independence. We think about the things that our country was founded on from the beginning. And I think keeping those traditions and having a yearly reminder of what this is all about. I mean, enjoy the fact that we have this incredible celebration, the 4th of July, where we have barbecues, we have picnics, we get to travel, and just take a moment and read some the Declaration of Independence or read from the Constitution, and just take a moment to step aside and think about that and say, you know, how can I continue that? How can I teach the next person about what this means? And so that, you know, these traditions of freedom and liberty are passed on to more generations, not down the line. It's not just about us. It's about those who come after us. There are many very brave people who are our founders who sacrificed everything so that we could have freedom generations further. And I think it's up to us to preserve that and continue that on for those in the future who have yet been unborn.
Jared, if you were here in person, I would salute you, Marine style.
Well, thank you very much.
You've just inspired me and encouraged me, and I just have been so glad to talk to you the day before the 4th of July. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and I would love to have you back soon.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you, and happy Independence Day to you and all of your guests.
We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. It is 31 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you today. I hope you're having a good day. Awfully glad that you're listening. I am a fan of interesting people. Stephen Mansfield is just that guy. Informative, enjoyable, inspiring, easy to understand, and very readable is exactly the way I would describe his book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, and an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. He's with us today on our studio line. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I have spoken to you before, and I have to say, I am a big fan, just so you know, right up front.
You're the one.
Yeah, I'm the
great
one. I'm laying all my cards
on
the table.
I have one.
Yeah. So, you know, you're a visionary, too. I got to say, you were talking about this 15 years ago, and people were going, what is this manhood stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, I'll tell you, we really are facing it now, aren't we? Every time we hear about a new young white shooter at a public school or every time we confront the Me Too movement, we're hearing a great deal about it. So on the one hand, I'm sorry that I was right. But on the other hand, at least we've had a few people out there trying to provide some answers.
Yeah. How come there's no shootings in inner city schools?
You know, that's a great question. I think probably there's, believe it or not, there's a kind of a healthy thing in inner city schools. I've spent some time in them. And even though you'll sometimes have guns there and even though you'll sometimes have violence, what you don't have as much is the outsider syndrome that tends to be part of the more suburban schools.
Sure, that makes
sense. The shooters with the in suburban schools tend to be lone wolf, young, white males, unfathered, untethered,
mm-hmm.
Who are treated as outsiders and feel themselves, you know, cursed in some way.
In an inner city situation,
young men feel like they belong. They may not be happy. They may be poverty stricken. They may be violent. But you don't have the lone wolf outsider, you know, seething kind of rage that has caused most of these shootings. So I think that may be the difference.
Yeah. Now, Stephen, we're talking about these droves of young men who are not getting a blessing from a father, helping them sort of navigate their way into manhood. That's producing lots of trouble in our world. And what are we going to do about it?
Well, I tell you what, we have to do a great deal. First of all, I'm reminded of an African proverb from the African villages that says, if we do not initiate the boys, they will burn the villages down. And that's what's going on. You know, whether we're talking about ISIS, we're talking about urban gangs, we're talking about these young white shooters, it's young boys not initiated, not tethered, who will burn the villages down. And I have to say, the good news is that we can make a difference. Psychologists tell us that an unfathered young man can have a man in his life who is not the biological father but still tries to make a difference. And that man can make as much as an 85% difference in the life of that young man, which means in my neighborhood, and I'm sitting in Nashville, Tennessee right now, I can make a difference in the life of a young man who doesn't have a father in the home.
I love that.
And I can make a difference to the point of 85%. So what we're going to have to do is build a manly culture and then initiate the boys into it and begin to mentor them and initiate them and raise them in the values of noble manhood.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, would you tell our listeners the story about you, your experience in Damascus when you felt like you came into manhood?
Sure. I'll do it briefly.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was working with some organizations to try to help the Kurds. And I was we would go in through Damascus and across the Syrian desert. Well, I got stuck in Damascus because my paperwork was bad. So a friend of mine in the Syrian parliament, this all sounds very cool now.
It sounds so cool.
The war's going on, but it was much calmer then. Decided to have a little party for me on a rooftop, and so I spent an evening with a bunch of men who barely spoke English, and they were trying to welcome their American friend. Most of them were parliamentarians. There were men who were bodyguards there. And after welcoming me and us kind of hemming and hawing around, me not being able to speak Arabic and them not being able to speak English, finally a man showed up from who'd been out in the rural areas in the desert, and he said, "Stephen, do you have a son?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "What is his name?" I said, "Jonathan." And then he, just like he was announcing second coming, he said, "Well, then you have a new name." And I didn't quite understand what he was saying. We got a waiter to help us. And it turns out that in Arab culture, when a man has a son, it's considered such an honor for him that they actually give him an honorary name. And it's Abu, which means father of, and a shortened version of the son's name. So the men on the roof began calling me Abu John. Well, when that was announced, I'm telling you, dancing broke out, music cranked up, food began to arrive. I mean, it was obvious that they were going to celebrate their American friend, even if they couldn't speak to him. So we danced, we carried on, there was all kinds of Arab dancing. I was dancing with men who had Uzis, you know, and when the guy you're dancing with has an Uzi, he leads. So we danced for a long time, and this just went on, food,
yeah.
and you know, these guys were Muslim, so there was no alcohol at all. I'm just saying we partied late into the night.
Uh-huh.
Finally, and then every so often, somebody would walk up to me, and in the only English they had, they would say, "Abu John," and give me a big hug, you know. So finally, 3, 4 in the morning, I got back to my hotel, and I sat up that night, the rest of the night, because something in me was different. Something had changed. And there I'd been on the roof with a bunch of guys I could barely talk to, but I finally realized what it was. This was the first time in my entire life that I'd ever undergone any kind of ceremony, party, ritual to welcome me to a phase of manhood. I lived a normal American life, grew up an American military brat, lived overseas, you know, college, grad school, marriage, children, all the stuff that most men go through. But at no time, at any point in my life, had anyone, had any group of men ever sat around and said, hey, welcome to manhood or welcome to this phase of your life. Here's what's going to happen. Let us pray for you. We're going to walk through this through with you. Here's some things you need to know. You know, congratulations on turning 13. Here's a sword you can put on your wall, or here's a plaque, or, you know, anything like that. There's never been any kind of ritual like that. And I think most men are that way. Well, I got to tell you, what I was changed by the fact that these men I could barely talk to and who weren't of my faith celebrated me as a father. It really did change me. When I came back to the States, I just looked around and I realized, you know, we do not have a manly lore that we're passing from generation to generation. That's what these rituals are for. You know, that our Jewish friends have the bar mitzvah where a young man at the age of 13 becomes a son of the covenant, you know, and is welcomed in the community as a man. We don't have that kind of stuff in Protestantism or even Catholicism. And so as a result, you know, I have to say I was dramatically changed by this initiation ritual. And I realized we've got to begin to not just have the ceremony. I'm not just talking about the dancing and the food. I'm talking about having a manly lore that we are practicing and passing on to the next generation. And that's what really launched me in the direction of writing this book and doing the speaking I do internationally to men, because I'm real concerned that, of course, men are in downward spiral. And that night showed me that, you know, even a bunch of Muslim guys, you know, dancing on a roof and celebrating me could change me. What more would happen, you know, if we were doing it in our own language and with a specific vision for noble manhood in our minds?
It's wise to have an event that punctuates a life of a young man, isn't it? Like a bar mitzvah.
It absolutely is.
Or what you went through, yeah. Stephen, what are some manly characteristics we need to be reminded of? Don't say home improvement projects.
Don't worry. I'm the worst at using a hammer.
Okay.
In my book, I emphasize the fact that men need to tend their field. This is one of the main principles for a man. You know, Paul said that he would not boast beyond the field assigned to him. And I take that language and I say, you know, for every phase of a man's life, teenage, college, later on, early marriage, children, what have you, a man has a field assigned to him. It's the total body of responsibilities and obligations that he has. And they're not all just duties and honeydews. They're also taking care of himself and making sure he's having rowdy fun with his friends and, you know, making sure he's wooing his wife or girlfriend, what have you. But I actually teach men on retreats. You know, we need to be knowing what the field assigned to us is. And this is, in my opinion, how a man really steps up in authority. This is how he grows and increases. He stands guard over everything that's in his field. He makes sure it fulfills its destiny. He makes sure it's healthy. The great original sin, if you're looking at the Bible as your guide in any way, the great original sin, of course, is man being irresponsible. I mean, you know, Adam stood right there and let Eve, you know, be deceived and cause all kinds of problems. Men have become irresponsible. What's our primary image of the man who's irresponsible? He's sitting in his recliner, you know, in sweaty, stained, you know, sweat clothes, and he's screaming for somebody to bring him a beer before the second half begins. And, you know, in the meantime, his house is falling down around his ears. His daughter's off with somebody named Spike on a motorcycle. His son's upstairs in front of the computer doing something his father doesn't know anything about. And the wife's angry and bitter and gaining weight. And the father's responsible for all of that. He's meant to be tending all of that and tending, making sure everything is nurtured and fulfills its destiny. But he doesn't do it. So I teach men that's the main step they have to make, is know their field and tend it well to the glory of God. Make sure everything's fulfilling its purpose and protected and cared for and nurtured. And that that includes, by the way, taking care of themselves. Most men don't take very good care of themselves. So that's where I start, at the most practical level.
Yeah, and I really like that. And I'm gonna ask you if you could talk in a very practical way. If you're tending your field, what are some things a man could do as early as this evening, which might be a step in the right direction?
Oh, gosh, all kinds of things. Well, first of all, you can constantly pray. I'm a big believer in that. But also, you know, most men, when they get home at the end of the day, they retreat, you know, in front of the TV and into the food and so on like that. Well, how about go walk up into your daughter's bedroom, your son's bedroom, take them aside, find out how they're doing, go for a walk, get in their world, find out what's troubling them. Begin to speak positive words into their lives. I'm proud of you. You know, you've got some amazing gifts that really impress me. And let's talk about what's challenging you these days. I want to help you through that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Get into their lives. Talk to them. Go to the spouse. Go to the wife. And, you know, how are you doing and what's going on and how can I help you? And, you know, I'm noticing a slight tendency towards bitterness there. Where's that coming from? I want to help you with that, you know, that kind of thing. And then take care of things around the home, tend the field, tend the house. I'm not saying paint the house and, you know, cover redo the roof tonight.
Thank goodness.
But I'm just saying, you know, I got to tell you, when I walk in and there's a light bulb undone in my home, I take care of it right away. I tend my field. I want my wife to know, but more than that, I want to actually be responsible. So there are some practical things that can be done like that. And then, of course, really, it's more of a long-term belief that this is your field and that you have to tend it. But things as simple as what I've described can happen, like you say, as soon as tonight.
Mm-hmm. Now, Stephen, I think God is the good shepherd, but on earth we've got our parents, which are our earthly shepherds. But if Dad's not around, then you start looking for like a partial shepherd, maybe someone in the neighborhood who's 2 years older, who you think is cool. And that has taken us into a place of disaster in our country because there's too many people that have too many young men who, without solid fathership or mentorship, have drifted into violence and crime and some of these things you've just talked about, laziness, inability to thrive. And it's really quite an epidemic.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Fatherlessness is an actual plague in our generation. And like I say, we can make a difference, but that's one of the things we've got to do. We've got to, in our every institution, schools, churches, government, we've got to emphasize fathers in the home. They make a massive difference. The difference between even a mediocre father in a home and no father in the home is just gigantic. But we thank God for the women who have just stood in the gap and taken the blows and just tended the home fires when men weren't around. But this is something we've really got to talk about and really got to deal with, and men have got to understand that whole idea of responsibility. And so if they're tending their field, if they understand that they're put on earth to tend their field to the glory of God, and that's how they thrive and grow and are given increase, then they won't be walking away from kids. And, of course, some of this is the sexual revolution. Some of this is the idea that, you know, man and woman come together, have casual, you know, almost entertainment sex, and the man's not responsible for what might be produced in the woman's life. We've got to deal with that kind of stuff, that kind of lie, because, again, we've got, especially, I spend a lot of time in the African-American community, and the African-American community is absolutely being devastated by a plague of fatherlessness. I think Barack Obama was correct about that. Much as I might disagree with him politically, he was correct about that. And I think it's something we have to strongly emphasize, especially from our pulpits.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, let me take a short break. When I come back, we'll continue our conversation with Stephen Mansfield. It is 15 minutes till the top of the hour. If you have a question for Stephen, we'll be happy to get it on the air, or you can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. Our number is 877-933-2484. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. 13 minutes till the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Stephen Mansfield. He's written many books. He's a New York Times best-selling author. We're talking about his Mansfield's Book of Manly Men. And Stephen, let me ask you this: are there men out there that feel like they need to be invited into this role of manhood? You know, men and women generally have a rebellious nature. But I think in the back of every man's head is a feeling that there's a design, but they don't know how to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is coded in us, and that's why men, I think, when they watch movies, for example, they read books, they're drawn to noble examples. Why did John Wayne capture so many hearts, so to speak? Why do you know, some of the movies that we admire, from Rudy to, you know, Apollo 13, whatever, wherever we see men doing manly things and doing noble things, why are we so stirred by that? Because something in the back of our soul says there is a model. We are meant to be walking on a plan and a purpose, and we are meant to be living noble lives. And so I think you're right. And yeah, men are, I think, a little bit more turned towards models and influenced by models and you know, that old principle of we become what we behold, even a little bit more than women. And so it's important that we put righteous models in front of them, that we have manly men that they can see and follow and emulate. And that's clearly what's going on in our society today, but not all of it's good.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, how are men doing when it comes to friendships?
You know, men are hurting when it comes to friendships. Surveys show that the average man today cannot name a best friend. The average man does not know who he would call to get his son out of jail if, you know, he was arrested at 2 or 3 in the morning and his father was out of town on a business trip. The one I like is that the average guy does not know who among his friends, if he even has friends, he would trust to go over at 4 in the morning and help his wife with some problem at the house, you know, if the husband was out of town on a business trip. You know, somebody who would handle it morally and ethically and yet competently. In England, the suicide rate for men over 50 is absolutely massive. If you are over 50 in England and you don't die of a heart problem, you are almost certain to have died of suicide. And when we do the psychological postmortem, it's all about loneliness. It's all about men actually leave notes and say, there's not a man on this earth who knows who I am or cares about me.
Ouch.
And they kill themselves. So that's why I'm a big, massive proponent of men needing to build a band of brothers. You know, 200 years ago, our ancestors had natural community, they had natural village, they had tribe, they had large families, et cetera. You had a built-in community of men. But today, with our, you know, cubicle lives and our individual cars and our individual houses and the dislocation of men, we've got to be intentional about building a band of brothers. And where I see that emphasized, where I'm teaching it wherever I go, I see men's lives really being changed.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, we have a caller who would like to join into the conversation. Jill from Detroit Lakes. Hello, Jill. Do you have a comment or question for Stephen?
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. My comment is that my husband, and I know there's many others out there in the Christian community, was a godly, still is a godly involved father. We live in the country. And even though he's a pharmacist, he did many things outdoors with our kids. And we still have a son who's 35, and he's an alcoholic and on drugs and has sexual addictions. And yet my husband didn't model any of that. And so I'm sure there's other dads out there that just need that word of encouragement, that even though they maybe did the best they could. I think there's a story by Chuck Swindoll about a father who gave his children everything they needed, and they still rebelled, and those children were Adam and Eve. So not that my husband's like God or perfect or anything, but I just know there's men out there that need a word of encouragement today.
I appreciate that, Jill. Stephen, do you have a comment on that?
I do, and I really appreciate you caring about your husband and the other men who are like him. You know, we have a promise in Scripture that when we raise our children up in the way they should go, that they will not depart from it. And yet many of us are seeing our children because, you know, we battle such amazing forces in the culture, in our broader society, being pulled away. But what you can be sure of is that your husband's example and imprint on your son's soul is there. It's absolutely there. In fact, I've talked to a lot of young men who would be, you know, we might say in the church world that they're in rebellion, so to speak. And many of them, what they're really contending with their alcoholism and their addiction, is the imprint of the father on their souls. They're squeezed between the positive imprint of their fathers in many cases and the more immoral imprint of the society. And this is part of what has them in tension. So we got to pray for them. We got to have confidence that there was not a failure on the part of the parents. You know, we need to be encouraged. And we need to bring them back. We need to give them a community to connect to. The fact is, and I'm not anti-church at all. Please don't hear me that way. But the survey showed that most men are just bored silly at church. And so we've got to have an exciting, dynamic, deep men's culture going on. That men like this young man who's astray can connect to, and that's going to be the solution. But I really appreciate hearing you care about both your son and your husband in this way.
Yeah, it's very sweet. Stephen, David knew what it was to be a man, and he used his final breath to give instructions to his son Solomon, and he said, "Be strong and show yourself a man."
Yeah, I love that story because that is one of the few times in the Bible when the word man does not just mean male. You know, we often see the word used that way. There were 6,000 men doing so-and-so, or 20 men did it. It just means male. But in that situation, some others in the Bible, it means the way of a man, the lore of a man, the nature of a man, the characteristics that make up a good man. David turned to his son Solomon and said, in the King James it says, show yourself a man. And I like that phrase because it means exhibit the good characteristics of what it means to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really think that's what we've got to do. That's what it means to have a manly culture, is that we're walking out those characteristics. We're walking out that lore. We're living that to the glory of God, and we're doing it in a contagious fashion.
Yeah. Stephen, as we're on the eve of the 4th of July, maybe we can try to learn something about the men that shaped this country, their values and their manliness.
You know, the founding generation of this country, they weren't perfect. They certainly had their blind spots. But I'll tell you, many of them lived unbelievably heroic lives. They committed to a higher cause. The vast majority of them were committed to God and were Christians. And they sacrificed and they fought well. I love reading their stories. I love reading about their friendships. I love reading about how close they were, and how they bound together. And they, you know, I love the phrase from the Declaration of Independence, how they pledged their honor to each other. That's something that men need to know how to do. And so the founding generation in this country, really for the most part, except for a few political blind spots and some social blind spots, they were way ahead of their time, and they are men that we can point to and say, look, follow them as they lived out noble lives. I think George Washington is an incredible example of character, nobility, and sacrifice, and really is the father of our country in many ways. And I would have no problem saying to my son, you know, live out character as he did. And that's something I think few countries are able to say.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, do men today live with more guilt and shame, or the same amount, or less?
Well, I think they tend to, you mean in the founding generation? I think we live with more guilt because men are failing more today. I don't think that the average guy living at the time of the founding, you know, was living in a lot of guilt because he was pressed up against it, man. He was living an aggressive life. He was serving his family. He was growing what he needed to grow. He was, you know, tending what he needed to tend, and he didn't feel a lot of guilt and shame. But men today, not only because of what society says about them, but also because how many of them are living, they do have a lot of guilt and shame. Modern psychology tries to remove that and say that it's the shame itself that is the issue, but that's not true. Men feel shame because there are shameful things in their lives in many cases, and because they're living less than what they really ought to be. But the good news is that a noble life, a meaningful life, a fully manly life is within reach. They just need some help. They need a band of brothers. They need a noble vision for what manhood is, to the glory of God, and then a change can be made.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, I have a couple of questions. How many years did you serve in the military, and do you have James Bond-like gadgets?
First of all, I've never served in the military.
I thought you did.
No, not me. My father was a high-ranking Army officer and a military intelligence officer, and for that reason I lived in Berlin during my teenage years. And then later, some people think I've served in the military because I was embedded with U.S. troops in Iraq and wrote a book called the Faith of America, of the American Soldier. And I was in Iraq for a number of months embedded with U.S. troops. But I personally have never served in uniform, although would have been delighted to. It wasn't any kind of protest. It was just the time of my life didn't seem to fit the need of my country.
Yeah, well, maybe I was remembering your dad's service.
He
sounded like
probably.
An amazing guy.
He was. And I do a lot with military, and so a lot of people think that I am military. But no, I've never actually served, but I love speaking to military crowds. I love honoring them. And I certainly was one of the privileges of my life was to get Pentagon permission to be embedded with U.S. troops in Iraq. And I was over there, you know, taking fire, watching some of them die, unfortunately, seeing the dangers, eating the food, you know, being there, watching surgeries take place, and getting their stories of faith. And it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you're a great writer and a cool guy, and I'm going to come to Nashville and take you to lunch.
Come on, man. Let's do it.
All right. I look forward to it. Thanks, Stephen, so much. Have a great 4th of July.
Great being with you. Thanks,
yep.
Thanks so much.
You
bye-bye.
Bet. That was Stephen Mansfield, his book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. It's a great read. We'll take a short break and head into hour two in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.